again, the same five classes of bacteria came out, and these are the gamma protea, the gamma beta and alpha proteobacteria, actinobacteria, and firmicutes. So it indicated that the B that was sequenced for the B genome also had these bacteria inside of it. And so the results from these three studies, the metagenomics, had 87% of these sequences match previously identified bacteria. The cloning experiment, there was 96 of these were associates, and in the honeybee genome, 95% of these sequences had best blastits to the organisms related to previously identified bacterial associates.
Paying comb, which contain honey, pollen, and brood, which is the developing bees, stages, eggs to pupae. So the mites on the bees may be randomly distributed within a colony, or they may be clumped, as in the brood area. And then the variation within an apiary. So the mites on the bees, some colonies may have, all the colonies either may have very similar levels of infestation, or some of the colonies may have higher loads, mite loads, as in these two. So what I did to find the distribution of the mites, I sampled a total of 30 apiaries across four states, California, Texas, North Dakota, and Minnesota. And in each of these apiaries, I sampled 30 colonies. So for each of these colonies, I have data on the date, the beekeeper, the state, which colony it was, the yard, and the direction of the entrance. For each of these colonies, I sampled each of the combs. So what I did is I recorded both comb location within the box, and I recorded what was on the comb, so the comb content, whether it be honey, pollen, brood, or empty. I also sampled 30 bees per comb in tubes filled with 20 mils of alcohol. So I brought these combs back to the lab, or tubes back to the lab, and I counted the number of bees and I counted the number of mites in order to get the infestation level per comb. And this is what I used to do my statistics. So I looked at a nested analysis of variance to see where the mites were congregating, mites on the bees were congregating within a colony. And so far, it looks as though they are randomly distributed within the colony. However, I need to look at more levels of analyses in order to confirm this. So I also looked at what the largest source of variation within an apiary is, and it does appear that some colonies have higher mite loads than others. So the second step I took was to look at how many colonies to sample per apiary and how many bees to sample per colony. So I used resampling for validation of sampling plans developed by Narhanio and Hutchison, and this RBSP uses two statistical methods, Taylor's power law and Green's plan. Taylor's power law generates two parameters. One of these tells the spatial distribution of mites, which it indicated that the mites were indeed clumping in colonies, so this reconfirms my nested analysis of variance. And then these two parameters were plugged into Green's law along with a set precision of 0.25 to generate a sample size, and it appears that the best estimation is given by sampling 11 colonies out of the apiary and 200 bees per colony. So far I've only talked about sampling mites on the adult bees. However, because mice reproduce on the pupae, which are kept in cells on the comb with a wax capping over them, this is a very important source of the mites as well. So I've sampled 185 colonies for the brood to look at the brood infestation levels. So I compare that to the infestation levels on adult bees and create a brood correction factor that will be used in conjunction with my information on adult bees in order to create a sampling device. So this is a prototype of my sampling device. So each of these funnels is a set volume which corresponds to a number of bees. So if a colony has no brood, then the mites on adults are representative of the entire colony infestation. So the 200 bee sample will be sufficient for sampling. However, if there is brood in the colony, the samples that beekeepers take should include the mites in the brood. So the volume they take of bees needs to be bigger. And I will figure out the volume of this using the brood correction factor. And this should give the beekeepers a standard tool that they can go out into the apiary and sample either one colony or multiple colonies at the same time and come up with an infestation level that they can compare to other beekeepers across the world. So finally, I want to publish sampling guidelines that beekeepers can use in order to make treatment decisions, educated treatment decisions. So I want to create guidelines and opposed to thresholds, because the level a beekeeper treats at will depend on their own personal operation and personal tolerance level. So a beekeeper that moves their colonies around for pollination will have a lower tolerance level to the mite presence, because their bees will be exposed to higher horizontal transmission of the mites, as opposed to a beekeeper who has their colonies in a relatively isolated area and keeps them in one location year-round. So presently, the virologist director has the upper hand in the relationship between bees, mites, and beekeepers. And because the mites are such a significant pest to beekeepers, the beekeepers really need a tool to bring the mites back into some kind of balance. All right, thank you. Yeah?
How long does it take to do this sampling technique in a large apiary?
So the question was how long it takes to do the sampling technique in an apiary. Well, it takes at least a full day and a half. It depends how many of the boxes the beekeepers have on their colonies. So it takes at least a day and a half if there's two boxes, and it'll take about a day if there's one box. Yes?
And taking on a threshold always takes into account the value of the crop. So when the crop is worth more and the economic threshold changes, is this going to be a part of your product?
So the question was whether or not the economic threshold would be a part of my product. No. So because economic thresholds take into account the value of the product, it's really hard. I found it really hard, at least, to kind of come up with some kind of value. Also, the threshold assumes that it would be the same for all the beekeepers, and I don't believe that it is. So. So the question is, because my population varies within a season, will I be using some kind of seasonal recommendation? Yes, in a way, because so I'll have those different volumes that beekeepers should sample with for the sampling gizmo. So if they use the different volumes, then that kind of makes it seasonal, because if they're just starting out rearing brood, or they're ending, then they'll have a different volume than if they're in the really high brood season in the midsummer. So. All right. Thank you.
A few other species. It's been relatively untested in ants, and it'd be really interesting to see.
Many of us are aware honeybees eclose as adults and begin to perform a series of in-hive tasks before transitioning to metabolically intensive flight behaviors outside of the hive. This transition is accompanied by a suite of physiological changes, including increases in metabolic enzymes such as pyruvate kinase and cytochrome C oxidase, which presumably are there to help support the increase of aerobic demands of high performance while foraging. However, while we typically associate the transition to these different behaviors as being an age-related response, we know that this is very plastic depending on the conditions within the colony and conditions within the environment. Therefore, one of our questions is, how does age and behavioral development affect the development of flight performance? To answer this question, we use a single cohort colony approach, where we created a colony using 1 to 2 day old bees, and from this group, the bees would then transition through their behaviors at different paces. Some bees would transition early and become precocious foragers, while other bees would become normal age nurses. We would then also have normal age foragers, bees transitioning across their normal temporal development, and then over age nurses as well. This approach allows us to look at flight performance comparing bees that are the same age amongst different behavioral groups, such as comparing precocious foragers to normal age nurses, as well as comparing bees that are performing the same behavior across age, such as comparing precocious foragers to normal age foragers and normal age nurses to overage nurses. We measured flight performance using mixtures of variable density gases, which were normoxic. Gases ranged in density from normal air, and then we replaced the nitrogen within the air content with helium to create a gas called heliox, which is 1/3 the density of air, approximately the density of the air at the altitudes of Mount Everest, posing a substantial aerodynamic challenge for hovering flight. While bees were flying in these variable density mixtures, we recorded the flight sequences using a high-speed digital video camera, which allowed us to then record stroke amplitude, wingbeat frequency, and wingtip velocity. Here we have a honeybee hovering in normal air. This honeybee is using a wingbeat frequency of about 230 hertz and a wing stroke amplitude of about 90 degrees. This same honeybee was able to hover in pure heliox. Notice in this picture, or in this video here, the honeybee's wing stroke amplitude is greatly increased, approximately 140 degrees in amplitude. And if we take a look at the wingtip trajectories, blue being air, red being the heliox condition, again, the challenges of flight in heliox are met with a large increase in the wing stroke amplitude to increase the wing speed to generate the aerodynamic lift required. Now, when we take a look at flight performance across age, flight performance on the y-axis here, again, in percent heliox, with 100% heliox being the best flyers. These are the bees that are able to fly in the least dense gases. Again, air down here, and then we had a couple observations of bees that were unable to fly at all. What we see here is that there is no effect of age on flight performance in nurses. There's a significant effect of age on flight performance in foragers, however, it only explains about 17% of the variation. The take-home message here is that at any age, foragers are better flyers than nurses. Now, why is this so? If we take a look at flight performance across body mass,